Hello, my name is Cliff Cumber, and I am the artist of Related Filth and the artist on Tony Esmond is a Movie Star, and you're listening to 11 O'Clock Comics.
He's back.
It's crazy. You know what the problem is? We left the door open.
Well, you know, last time I was here, I think I left my reading glasses. So for the past 4 days, I haven't been able to draw anything. I can't read anything.
Oh, that's the problem.
Yeah. So, yeah, I got all my deadlines are fucked now.
Well, you say you won't be able to draw anything. Vince would hand-deliver your glasses to you if he knew.
Oh, I would run there.
Yes.
The truth of the matter is I take my glasses off completely to draw because my eyes are so messed up. I can't. I have to put my face against the drawing board. So.
Wow. Yeah, I noticed myself doing that too. But I mean, it's not to that extent, but the eyes aren't what they used to be. Yeah.
Nope. And it happened quick. Like, it happened right at the beginning of COVID. Like, just I woke up one day, I'm like, God, I can't see up close anymore.
Yikes. Yep. Well, we're going to take you up close to some comics because this is 11 O'Clock Comics episode 911. And I'm Vince B.
You are Vince B. I am David A. Price.
And yet again, the genius returns. Kankor's Matt Allison is with us again. Yay!
I was going to say I'm Frank Frazetta Jr.
Oh, boy.
Hey, he's got paintings up in a museum, okay?
He does.
Yeah.
I met him.
Yep.
I did too.
And yep. I don't know if it was just because of the setting, which was at the Frazetta Museum, but mm-hmm. He was very cordial and obviously wanted us to buy something.
Sure.
But so schmoozing, but he spent a good amount of time with us.
Yeah, that is true. We got a Groupon actually for guided tour and very informative. Unfortunately, most of the information was that's not an actual painting, that's a print. I heard that multiple times throughout the thing, but so be it. What I did see there that was an actual painting was mind-blowing, so it was well worth it.
And there's a good amount of them.
Well, when did you go?
Oh, Dap, when did we go?
Oh, it was, crap. Was it right after COVID? Or was it just before? It was in February. Yeah, I'd have to look it up.
We went during COVID and
it had to be before COVID because we also went to the wine spot. Yeah. Okay, so I think it was probably a year or two before COVID.
Okay, yeah, I was surprised at how few actual paintings were in there. He talked about it. He talked about selling them, and I know that part of the deal when the kids split up all the collection was that he got to keep the property. So I know he gave a lot of stuff to the other kids just so he could keep the museum and the land that it's on.
It's a tragic tale.
It is. Well, and I didn't realize too that one of the other brothers, or I guess the only other brother, he runs a costume shop not far from the museum, and I guess up above the costume shop are his paintings, you know, his paintings that he got, you know, from Frank Sr. You know, again, all the four kids split them up four ways, and they're on display there, which I had no idea. So had I known that, we would have made the trek into this costume shop and checked those out too.
Wow, that's crazy. It just gives me the object of thinking that there's Frazetta originals above a costume shop. Like, what if, right?
Yeah.
You think of all the damage that could happen. I mean,
well, the other museums in Boca Grande, Florida. So it's like, and right off the coast, you know, it could very easily be destroyed in a hurricane.
Poor Frank. Yeah. I can't catch a break.
Yeah.
But you can catch a break if you solicit our sponsor, cheapgraphicnovels.com, because the prices are so low, you're not going to find them cheaper anywhere. Omnibus editions, trade paperbacks, manga, OGNs, all of them at rock bottom prices. And place your order, receive the email confirmation, respond to the email confirmation saying 11 o'clock comics sent me, and you'll get free shipping on your next order. Savings on top of savings. It's crazy. CheapGraphicNovels.com. They're the best.
Nice.
And so is this drink.
Yeah?
Very tasty. It's blackberry lemonade. Like I said, ooh, I have so much of this stuff. Yeah, I just love it so much. I used to drink a lot of diet soda, a ridiculous amount of diet soda, like Jason with the Diet Dr. Pepper. And since I've removed myself from that, I feel much better. And this is going on years.
Yep. We did the same thing. We got rid of all diet soda. We have a small fridge in our mudroom, and that's all we kept in there. And now it's just all sparkling water.
Better for you. Yeah. Yep. What you got, Dap?
Nothing fancy. I'm just trying to, I think, fight off a little bit of a cold. So I'm just going to enjoy some nice, refreshing room temperature water.
That's what I got. Same here.
Excellent.
Wow. If Jason were here, he'd be berating the both of you.
True. While he's sipping on G-Zero.
Out of a glass slipper, though.
Of course.
So, yeah.
Does he ever do the Peloton while you're recording?
No. There's lines that are drawn, and that's one of them. Okay. That's like eating potato chips. I'd be like, what are you doing?
Yeah. Well, could I want to talk about Jason real quick.
Do it, please.
Well, he's not here?
Yeah. No, I he'll listen, hopefully. I just wonder, and he's never talked about this, does he own art from the Ohatmus? Like, yes.
We gifted him the master edition the later years when Keith Pollard did the front, back, and side profile images. He has a page from that series.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, because I check out the Heritage auctions every now and then.
Yeah.
And I don't want to bug him because I know he looks at them too. But every time I see something from the Ohatmu, I'm like, oh, I wonder if Jason's seen this. So that's okay. Good to know.
He does love those Ohatmus.
I do too. Does.
They're so much fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
In terms of value for the dollar, though, crazy. I mean, it takes forever to read a single issue of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. I did. The technical aspect of it and how text dense the Ohatmus were, they were fantastic. And I would always enjoy trying to figure out if I knew which panel the comic came from when they showed mm-hmm. characters' powers and abilities. But I think if they were, instead of actually trying to copy what Marvel did, I really do appreciate what DC did with Who's Who. And just, you had the main image of the character, and in the background in one color, you had the character in action by whichever artist, generally the artist that they're claiming the fame was working on that character. And unfortunately, though, they focused on the art, but the art kind of infringed a bit on the page with all the text, so you may not have gotten everything about the character's origin or their specific details. You had some great images, but as far as being like a true encyclopedia, it's hard to beat the Ohatmus.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
You.
Well, I was just going to say the great thing about the Who's Who is they got some weirdo artists in there. Like Jaime Hernandez is in there, and I actually got him to sign one of his drawings in there. And Trina Robbins. God, who did I see in there? Lots of Dave Stevens. The Dave Stevens drawings.
Oh, a dolphin! Holy shit!
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I'd be hard pressed to pick one or the other in terms of you know, what I enjoy most in terms of the art. Yeah. But yeah,
I think the decision to commission new character images in the Ohatmus got right what the Marvel saga got wrong. Because I appreciate the Marvel saga for what it is, but it's just a bunch of panels pulled from from original issues with a great retelling of the events surrounding it. But had they not commissioned new images for the Ohatmu, I don't think it would be as beloved as it is.
Yeah, I'm surprised because when you think about, was it called The History of the DC Universe, the one that was illustrated by Perez?
Yeah, right.
That was all, you know, his stuff. And that's beautiful work. Like, he really put a lot of effort into that. And so, you know, the fact that Marvel didn't have something comparable is a little surprising. But I know, like, with the Ohatmus, there was a Tomorrow's issue of either back issue, where they talked about how they all of that came together. And it was crazy. They were, like, pulling all-nighters. Just full staff, everybody in the bullpen working on that thing to get it done. And it's unbelievable just the amount of work and research that went into that.
Right. Yeah. Tons.
And I don't think Elliot R. Brown has had more work published in anything other than before that. Before or after, whether it was
that's his 15 minutes. That's it, man. Yeah. Andy was right. Yeah.
Yep.
All right, we have a little topic to delve into, but it is by way of a question that Matthew asked me because he knows I love Howard the Duck, and begrudgingly I will admit that I love Kiss, and he asked me this question. He said, "Okay, here's the deal: you're an editor at Marvel in 1977. Kiss has just appeared in Howard the Duck number 13." And the Muckety Mucks are telling you the band needs to be incorporated into the Marvel Universe with a 3-issue arc. What title do you drop them into, and who's the creative team? So I have an answer for that.
All right.
I think if not for Howard the Duck, the best place to put Kiss is the Defenders.
Okay.
Because it was just always an odd, quirky, super left field title of I don't want to say second string characters, but just the weirder side of the Marvel Universe. I would demand that Steve Gerber write it.
Okay.
And I think the best artist for it, I don't want anybody flashy to illustrate Kiss, I think because I was branded by Gene's approach. Because Gene, for all intents and purposes, is not a very flashy artist. And the fact that he rendered a matter-of-fact version of Kiss, it wasn't exaggerated very much. It was just, here's these guys that came out of, you know, this girl. I would put Sal Buscema on it.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't need a lot of sparkle with Kiss because the costumes are outlandish enough. 77 costumes anyway.
Yeah, you don't want to get too style. And that was the thing why I never picked up any of the 90s Psycho Circus and Beyond comics, was it just got way too crazy with the, you know, all the details on the costumes and stuff. I think, you know, like the what people say with Kiss, keep it simple, stupid. You want it fairly simple. Right. Yeah, that would make sense.
And then we spiraled out a little bit, and I said, well, Gene's, even though Gene's version of Kiss was the first comic book version to which I was exposed, he's not the artist that I immediately associate with Kiss. Whenever I think Kiss, this artist pops into my head. You know who that is?
Ken Kelly?
Yeah.
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 Wow.
because of Destroyer and Love Gun. Yeah, it's just Ken Kelly was the template for me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I could see, you know, if they commissioned him to do the covers, that would make total sense.
Like Richard Corbin and Bat Out of Hell, do you think the Destroyer cover was Ken Kelly's peak saturation? Like, I love Richard Corbin.
Yeah.
And I think Corbin has done masterful work his entire career. But just in terms of eyes on the work, I don't think he ever managed to outdo the Bat Out of Hell cover. Because, like, what, 37 million people bought that album?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was so ubiquitous and then got swiped on the, you just bought or ordered the Bruce Lee set. Bruce Lee Fights Back from the Grave.
Right, right.
That poster is a ripoff of the Bat Out of Hell poster.
Right, there's a lot of ripoffs of that.
Yeah.
And I think, I'm pretty sure that the bat on top of the spire was a, quote, reimagining of a bat from Neverwhere. Like, Corbin created a similar bat and just ran with it a little bit. Like, it's very similar to the bat. And it's either Neverwhere or the second one, Second Den. But, so, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that bat being on top of that always reminded me of there's a Wrightson cover where there's a, you know, like a giant bat creature on the top of a tombstone, similar wingspan and all that. Yeah.
There are images that I will take with me to my grave. Bat Out of Hell and Destroyer are two of them.
Yep. I almost got Gene's boot from Destroyer tattooed on my arm. I sat on that for years. I was like, you know, and then luckily talked myself out of it after the reunion tour. But yeah, I was just transfixed by that as a kid. I mean,
yeah,
I liked the music as a kid for the most part, but it was the album covers and just their look. And I had a, you know, I went and saw them in 79. And by the way, David and everybody else listening, the whole point of this was just to be able to talk about Kiss in this episode.
Oh, shameless. Yeah. Shameless. Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those things that if you were to say, like, pick 10 things from the 70s that visually define that era, I would choose the Destroyer cover. Like, it's, yeah, everybody's familiar with it. Even if they've never heard a song off that album, like, they know that image.
And then we had the solo albums with absolutely gorgeous painted covers by Carguati. And then you opened it up, and there was those shit in the rocking. Like,
yeah, what's the deal with that?
I have no idea. I've never been able to figure that out. The style was not what I expected. It was just so strange.
Yeah.
And the way that you had to fit them in, there was a tab coming off the one, and then it's just weird, just really strange. Yeah. But anyway, so then the topic kind of steamrolled, and we have another little exercise here where the pairing of musical acts with comic book artists. And I'm not talking rock and roll comics where the artist would specifically delineate a history aspect or a historical aspect to a musical artist. That's boring. We're not talking about that. But maybe a conceptualizing of a song or just an overall condensing of a musical act or solo performer into sequential art, what artists would we pair with specific performers? I think it's a cool little exercise. I surprised myself a lot because, as usual, I went deep on a lot of these. And I'm going to just start it off and make David very happy I think I have discovered the perfect artist for Iron Maiden.
Hmm.
Okay.
Now, I'm not going to get... yes, I will give you clues. I'm specifically thinking about the Trooper, Aces High, 2 Minutes to Midnight, Run to the Hills. What artist would be the absolute perfect visual stylist to make those a graphic, a sequential adaptation of those songs?
Would it be someone who did work for EC Comics?
Yes.
Okay. I'm gonna guess Wally Wood.
Close. You're very close.
I'm thinking Johnny Craig.
Nope. You're half right. John Severin.
John Severin, that makes sense.
Can you imagine a John Severin Aces High? Like, stop. Or the Trooper. He would be absolutely perfect for that. And now I can't get it out of my head.
That's good.
Yeah, the first person that popped in my mind, and I think just because of the association of... I always, when I see Eddie, I think of Judge Death, so I would think of... Brian Boland,
yeah. Well, I didn't... This may not fit. I didn't want to get too exaggerated because here's how I approached all of the inclusions on this list. I looked at the style of music, whether it's complex, experimental, like heavy or pared down, and I tried to find an artist with a visual style that would complement the sound. Like, I think Maiden is very complex,
mm-hmm.
and so is John Severin. There's a lot of line work going on with Severin. Severin has the war edge and the combat experience. And I forget who it was that said, you know, if you want a piece of history rendered accurately, you never had to search for reference. You just had to ask John Severin to draw it, because everything he drew was accurate to the point of like almost being overblown. Like, everything looks just right. And I think Severin would be a great complement to that very dense, layered, complex Maiden sound.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially when you consider, you know, so much of their lyrical content has to do with historical figures.
Mm-hmm.
So you plug this, you know, horrific character into, you know, stuff with Alexander the Great and whoever else. And then, but then you could also work in Edgar Allan Poe. And yeah, he's versatile enough to handle all that.
Rime of the Ancient Mariner? Oh, my mm-hmm. goodness. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, and I'm not playing by the rules, so I should. Oh, I did, didn't I? I asked you what you would pair it with before I gave you my answer. So that's how we're gonna, just like we did those days ago.
And I'll be honest with you, I'm in that mode of like going to school and realizing there was a test. I didn't have enough time to like fully form answers for these, so I figured, you know what, I'm gonna wing it.
Yes, that's perfect.
Very much, you know, word association.
That's perfect. Perfect. Yeah. Dap, do you have any?
I have two that came to mind and one that I had fun with, but I didn't have the full assignment. No, I'm not making excuses. I didn't know the full context of the assignment. So I wasn't thinking about any sort of autobiographical comics. I didn't want so and so to tell. You know, we already have Dave Chisholm doing a bunch of books, so I'm not trying to replicate that. But yes, if the musician showed up in another comic, I didn't necessarily think about what story they'd appear in, just who I'd like to see illustrated. And the first one that came to mind, although I immediately, once Vince started talking about them appearing in a comic, this one clicked because I already had the artist, already had the illustrator, I had the musical, I had the musician, and I think if I could see Miles Davis in a Question comic illustrated by Dennis Cowan.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, as a character, I think Dennis would do great. Yeah. In terms of Miles's music, I don't know if Dennis would be
true.
The right.
No, yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, totally
as far as the darkness that of his personal life, his demons, I could, yeah. But I mean, as far as like trying to illustrate the music, no. I say we already, I mean, Chisholm already did that.
All right, I'll throw some out and you guys just riff.
All right.
Okay. Pink Floyd.
I'm going to go with a European artist on that. I would go with someone like Kaza.
Yes. Yeah.
Or maybe Inky Bilal.
Oh, I think, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Pink Floyd?
No, I am drawing a blank.
I have an obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
Ralph Steadman. That's, yeah.
There's another musician that you're going to mention later that maybe I think might be more suited, but I could definitely see that.
Yeah. I also tagged Trad Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Michel Fife. And this is maybe the odd man out, but I think this person would do a wonderful job with the more bleak, specifically The Wall, Art Spiegelman.
Mm, wow. Yeah, I could see that.
And the story that keeps coming to mind is the Spiegelman's story in the first issue of Comics Book, where it's just a mishmash of conceptual styles based on the characters, like Potato Head and there's a Dada aspect to it. There's a Cubist aspect. Like that would, I think, be really cool paired with Pink Floyd, because I mean lyrically they're all over the place, right?
Mm-hmm.
How about this? This is another no-brainer. Ramones.
I would go with Spain Rodriguez.
Ooh.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. That grittiness there would definitely fit that.
Yeah.
That's a good one. Oh, man. Shit.
I'm going to say one. You're going to be like, ah. Mark Hansen.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, John Holmstrom.
That was the first thing that popped in my mind. Like,
right.
The guy did album covers.
Like, yeah, but he already did it. So I tried to find artists within the John Holmstrom approach. I have Pete Bagg, Gilbert Shelton, S. Clay Wilson, Kevin Eastman, I think would do a great job on a Ramones song. Just because Eastman has that gritty shit underneath your fingernails type scratchy style.
Yeah.
That kind of, at the time, I'm looking for guys that just threw the middle finger to mainstream visual styling within a comic book. And I think Kevin Eastman at the time was a very big, and you got to give Peter Laird credit too, a very big middle finger towards that. You have to do it this way, clean and bright, and that's not what Eastman and Laird brought to the table, especially with the duo shade paper. And it was at times very muddy and very scratchy, and I think dirty because of the city. And I associate the Ramones with, you know, the cityscape within Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So it's, yeah. I mean, there's really no right answer.
No, I could see that. And you could, you know, that's an interesting team up to do a Turtles Ramones team up, you know, because when you think about it's all about, you know, throw those guys in the sewer, give them some pizzas. They're going to be happy sitting with a bunch of turtles. And, yeah. I, you know, who I just thought of was Doug Allen. The guy who did Steven.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be cool. Yeah. Really neat.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. I wanted to put the Grateful Dead on here, but the only artist I could think of was Tim Truman.
Sure.
That's duh, right?
Mm-hmm.
How about the Pixies?
I'm gonna go with Dave McKeon.
On my list.
And because he could illustrate that dynamic, the quiet, loud thing, visually, I think, in a way where you could have very simplistic images and then a page turn into just an explosion of ink, which is like getting to the chorus of a Pixie song.
Right. I have specifically non-digital Dave McKeon because I don't want any of that, you know, photo manipulated.
Yeah. Crap. Oh, yeah, 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 for sure.
Even though he took the photos himself, it's still very, yeah. Anybody for the Pixies, Depp?
No. No, sadly.
I got Shaky Kane, Eddie Campbell, Dan Clowes, Sophie Campbell, and Charles Burns.
Yeah, see, everybody is softer than anybody I would have... anybody that came to mind. And these are all, obviously, these are great picks. Nothing I would have come up with would have done anything justice.
Ooh, I got to go back to the Ramones real quick. I think Julie Ducey,
yes,
would do a great Ramones comic.
Yep.
And in particular, like, so my favorite Ramones album is Pleasant Dreams.
Oh, you're so weird.
Oh my God, that album's so good. I won't tell you what my second favorite is because you'll hate me forever. But that album, like each song tells a story, and I think that would be a great complete graphic novel just to base them off each of the songs on that album.
I know what you're gonna say. What's your
second one?
Yeah.
What is it?
No, just tell me.
This is a sentimental favorite, just because it was one of the first albums that I purchased on my own, but Too Tough to Die.
Oh, I didn't think you were going to say that.
I know Ramones fans that hate that album. Despise it.
Yeah, it's an odd one. Yeah. I was actually going to go with Acid Eaters.
I've never owned that.
Yeah, that's the one that everybody's like, ugh. But, I mean, they never released a bad album. That's,
yeah,
I think you have to take a lot of things into consideration when you're dealing with the Ramones. But, yeah. You may not have choices for this one, but I think I figured out a great artist for Tom Waits.
Oh.
Any additions to Tom Waits?
I'm thinking, do you know the French artist? I never know how to pronounce. I'm assuming it's Blutch or Blutch, Blutch.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I for whatever reason that popped in my mind, or is it? I always get these confused. Who's the writer and who's the artist? There's Munoz and Sampaio.
Oh my God, Sinner. You are uncanny. Okay. That's Jose Munoz was the artist.
Yes,
Sampaio was the writer,
and it always confused me because Munoz was always credited first, which is not normal in the United States. So yeah,
really strange. I also have for Tom Waits Mazzucchelli.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
And Jason Latour.
Okay.
Just because I think Latour's a really great illustrator, and is very versatile with features and form, and I think he'd be stupendous mm-hmm. on Tom Waits something. I have a lot more. I mean, if you want us to play this, I got a long freaking list.
Well, do you have Motorhead on the list?
I don't.
Okay.
Wow.
I just immediately thought Simon Bisley.
Ah, dude, motherfucker.
Yeah.
What I was actually going to say.
Yeah, it's kind of perfect. It's kind of perfect. Yeah. How about Frank Zappa?
See, that's where I was going to go, Ralph Steadman.
Nice. Yeah, that would be perfect. Yeah.
Yep.
So I struck Cal Schenkel and Gary Panter from the list because they've already done stuff.
Okay. For Frank.
So I went Josh Bayer, Brian Chippendale, Steve Mannion, I think would be absolutely dead center for Frank Zappa. And Lukasz Kowalczyk, you know, the guy who did Frankenrocker? Remember I talked about, this is way going back. Yeah, he's got a really neat faux naive style that I think would be great for Frank. But again, like anybody that has, like, you could even say Sienkiewicz for Frank, right?
Yeah, that would be, you know, you could put Sienkiewicz on anybody who's, you know, more bombastic and avant-garde like that. I know Liberatore did an album cover for Zappa, right? That automatically you would think that, but yeah, you don't want to.
Yeah, you said Cheap Trick to me.
Yes,
and it's really weird because one of my favorite bands ever. I didn't have them on my list, but when you posed that question, it immediately hit, and I think it may be because of the checkerboard motif that this artist used on one of his books.
Mm-hmm.
Evan Dorkin.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, that seems the most likely thing. And, you know, Rick Nielsen is like a walking cartoon character already. Yeah.
And he's so, well, at the time he was so oddly shaped and just one of those types of characters that Dorkin would exaggerate even more. Yeah, I think it would be really, really well done.
Yeah.
What else? I mean, you guys have any that you want to throw this way? Or?
Well, I had mentioned Devo, and the first thing that came to mind when I thought about that was Lloyd Llewellyn era Klaus. And I just picture him drawing the five guys standing in, you know, a perfect line together with their hats done in Zipitone. I can picture that.
Yeah. He'd do really good things with like Bougie Boy and because Velvet Glove is, there's a lot of Devo in Velvet Glove.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And that's pretty much all. I mean,
who, let me throw this at you, Guitar Wolf.
It's not easy coming up with them on the fly, is it?
No.
I'd have to go with somebody who's as versatile in design as illustration. Because Guitar Wolf is in that neighborhood of the Cramps, right?
Yep.
So somebody really Mitch, what's his last name? Is it O'Connell? Mitch O'Connell.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I would say even though he's already got, you know, like Gorillaz, but I would say Jamie Hewlett.
Right. Yep.
What is the the artist who did basically wrote Fury Road with George Miller, British artist. Gosh dang it.
Wow, I don't know this. Who is this person?
He did that book Skin.
Oh, with the kid with the the big the ears. Yeah. Oh, gosh, damn. Dude. Yeah, okay.
I'm losing my mind.
Yeah, that'd be really good. Somebody, but it would have to have a component of grotesque, too. So...
Yeah, that's why I would think he would be good at that.
It would be nice to be in charge of an anthology and somebody throw, like, scads of money my way and say, here, here's a couple million dollars. we want you to public like Z2 Comics or something, because they do a lot of musical based comics, and that was one of my problems with the Anthrax book. Like, it was good, but I don't think it was, like, because David and I looked at it, I forget what convention we were at, and we're looking through it, and I'm like, yeah, this is kind of cool, this is neat. Ooh, like, every other story would be like not quite there, you know.
It's a tough thing doing music stuff because, you know, I did that story with Phil Hester for Heavy Metal based on a High on Fire song.
Right.
And the editor said, we don't want you to just adapt the lyrics. So we want you to just take the essence of what this song is and come up with something. And I think Phil did a really good job. I did a pretty piss poor job of illustrating what he had in his script, because he had really great ideas for adapting that, and it was a challenge, real challenge.
Well, I think you're being unkind to yourself, but that is you, right?
Well, I mean, I only say that because, you know, when you write for yourself, it's real easy to edit on the fly, and if you don't feel like drawing a certain thing, you change it. Whereas you're going off of somebody else's script, sometimes you miss nuances that you don't even think about till later. I mean, after the magazine came out, I went back and looked at Phil's script and reread it, and I was like, man, there's this whole element here that I just did not catch when I read it the first five times. And Phil never said anything to me about it, but I'm sure he was disappointed, because it was this really cool part of the story that I just glossed over. So, yeah. But
did you have much contact with him? Did he just, like, give you the script and that was it, or did you have?
I mean, it's one of those things where if you don't know you've missed it, you don't really know to ask. Like, hey, you know. But it was such a tight deadline; there was no time for him to really get my penciled pages and make notes or anything like that. I think it was basically like, all right, good enough. This is due in a week and a half. You need to just start working on it. So,
yikes. Well, yeah. I mean, I obviously haven't seen the script, but I think you did a great job on the visuals. There's something that I don't know left out, it didn't seem like, sure, like something was left out. Yeah. It's amazing that the product of creators that work closely, you can almost, I don't even know how to phrase this, but there's something that comes out of a collaboration when artists are in a studio environment, where it's just like, here's the script, see it in 22 days.
Yeah, right? For sure. It's something, you know, I wish that I had, you know, stayed in school. I wish that I had taken a job where I was working closely with other artists, so that you can learn and you can collaborate and get critiqued and all of those things that help you grow as an artist. I think that would have benefited me greatly.
Yeah. Do you think the bullpen environment contributed a lot to the early Marvel success? I mean, it sure feels like they were all in the same room, even if they weren't. It feels like there was a cross-pollinization of ideas going on at Marvel.
I think the competition aspect of it helped. You see what the other person's doing and you feel right. Like you need up right. Your game, and
can you imagine Jack being in the same room? Like, oh, yeah, I'm done. See you. Yeah, it's been nice knowing you. Yeah, it's just, it's amazing what can be achieved, you know. And it's also interesting to see the solo works where there's one guy, like, okay, in the case of Dave Sim, two guys, but one's doing backgrounds, mm-hmm. where you have this creative powerhouse that just unleashes 300 issues of something, and it's almost this perfect thing that could only be done by that one person. Like, I don't know if I have that in me, you know? And I don't think a lot of artists have that. I mean, we've seen powerhouse visual stylists try to do something on their own, and, you know, they just fall flat on their face. Where the collaborative aspect of it seems to unlock things.
For sure. And it all just depends on who you are and whether you learned early on to adapt to that environment. You know, when I was working a day job, I was always just as self-sufficient as I could be. I didn't want people's help. I'd rather just take on more work and crank it out and hustle and just do it all myself so I had complete control. And I was always that way. Like, throughout school, if I had to pair up with another person for an assignment, I hated it. And there were times when I would, you know, like, back out of something. You know, you're supposed to, like, go to another kid's house to work on an assignment. And I remember we had this one project in English class where we were supposed to do a parody of something, and the kid I was paired with, like, I didn't even know he was in the class. He was so quiet. Like, I don't remember his name. And I was just like, I don't want to work with this kid. It's going to really destroy what I want to do with this. So I lied to the kid, and I'm like, I can't come to your house. And I ended up doing a parody of the morning announcements, and I recorded it on a cassette tape, and I did all these voices of teachers and other kids and brought it in, and it just destroyed. Like, the class was dying laughing and the teacher was dying laughing. And I remember looking back at that kid that I was supposed to be partnered with, and he just was so crestfallen, and it was his turn to present his, and he just didn't even do one. But the point being is, like, that's just how I've always been that way. Like, I just want to do everything myself. I just want to handle every aspect of it. But if this is okay to segue into, you and I have been collaborating.
I don't know. Yeah, I'm thinking you're being very generous when you say collaborating. I basically put the quarter in the vibrating bed and let the thing do its job.
Well, I mean, I think that in this particular instance, and we're talking about we're working on a story for Metal Herlant. The project came my way to do something for an H.P. Lovecraft issue. And immediately, that was the very first thing that popped in my head. Like, I got to get Vince in on this.
Nice, yeah.
Partly, you know, because I'm not well-versed in Lovecraft. I've gotten more so over working on this project. But, you know, I needed somebody to bounce ideas off of. And I needed a collaborator for this particular thing, because it was like, it's going to fall flat if I don't. If I try to just wing this and put in aspects that I think are Lovecraftian, people will know, you know, that I don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. So, you know, that it had to happen. We had to work on this together.
Well, I'm very grateful for the opportunity, but a lot of the, and I have it recorded, all of our brainstorming sessions, I have it mm-hmm. all recorded. It's neat because, and it happens when I'm teaching too, and never ceases to amaze me what happens when more than one brain is involved in mm-hmm. a creative solution. Like, whenever I give an assignment, I'll solicit opinions from the kids, and they're like, hey, what if we do this? And I'm like, holy shit, like, I never thought about that. And I'll take what they gave, and I'll be like, that's really amazing, but how about if we add this to it? And this thing starts to take shape that I had not conceived in my wildest dreams. And I will take that and commit it to paper. Like, that's the assignment for future students, like, you know, semesters in the future. And what we were doing was you would say something, I'd be like, oh, that's cool, but how about if we just add this wrinkle? And this thing spiraled out of it, and then, I mean, we took it to a certain point, and then this is the great part. You fleshed it out even further to your sensibilities, and I can't wait, because I've seen images, and it's like, holy crap. Like, I could never.
That, I'm sure you're looking at, like, we didn't even talk about that. What's going on?
No, but that's the great part of a collaboration. Like, yeah. I have the utmost confidence in you. Like, there's you among everyone. Like, I know what you are going to deliver. And the things that you have committed to paper, like, you keep, I don't want to say improving, because that makes it seem like that you need work in certain areas, but that's not what I mean. You keep evolving that style into areas that, like, I don't want to say too much without giving something away, but you have this cosmic explosion sequence thing where, and it's like, oh my God, like, I never ever would have conceived what we talked about being translated into those marks. Like, it's crazy.
Well, you had reviewed, I think it was you, it may have been Jason, a Junji Ito book not too long ago, and you were discussing the fact that he is pretty freewheeling in his creative process, where if, you know, he may put something in a script, but as he's drawing it, if he feels like there's a better route to go.
Yeah.
It's a David Lynch approach, and it's one that I'm really in tune with. Like, I just feel like if you feel in the moment this isn't right and you need to go in another direction, you got to go in another direction. There's like whole panels in this thing that I have to redraw, because I'm like, I realize something about this particular character physically that needs to change, because it applies to the theme of the entire piece, so I have to change that. Whereas if it was a script that was just handed to me, I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that, because I'm like, oh, I got to be beholden to this thing, even though I think there may be a better way to right. express it on the page. So I hope I'm not veering too far off of what, you know, our initial vision of this thing was. But
no, I think your instincts are right on the money, because case in point, we had to get Dap, the characters, in a certain place to make the story work.
Okay.
And we had this way of doing it that we thought, okay, this'll work. But then Matt came up with something that was much better. And I thought, yeah, that's even more powerful, because the initial way we conceived it wouldn't have given you a wide angle view of location, but the way he did it, it's immediate. Like, you know, the setting is right there. And I thought that was a better way to work it out.
And you guys have talked about this often, about the difficulty of writing a short story, because you've got limited space.
Yeah.
You know, you gotta condense things and compress them. So, you know, I'm used to just doing this meandering stream of consciousness type material. And so it's a good exercise to sit there and think, okay, what's the best way to get these people from point A to point B to point C, have it all make sense? You know, it's we read so many comics, and we take in so much media and so much pop culture, that we take a lot of it for granted. And the story writing process is hard. It's much easier to think, well, this is totally open ended, and so I can have the sequence play out for as long as I want, as opposed to, oh shit, I got three panels to get this guy over here. What's the best way to do that? And then you end up, you know, I'll just, you know, slightly spoil some of this, but, you know, these characters are now flying in an airplane. I didn't realize how difficult it was to draw an airplane. It's hard, because you've got multiple geometrical shapes at different perspectives from each other, with all of the wings and the fins and everything. And so now I'm like, why did I do that? But it was the best way to get these characters where they needed to be.
And again, not to spoil it because you won't see it, but initially we had the characters, one in particular, the viewpoint being from the back seat of a car. And I thought, as we were talking about it, I thought, man, I would not want to be the one that had to draw this, because a windshield is only so, a windshield only allows for so much view of, you know, location. And then you have the logistics of the dashboard and the characters in the front and the seat and the person in the seat actually looking through. It would be I mean, there's so many problems to solve with that, where you just put them in an airplane. And I was like, wow, that's really smart. Right. And it achieves the same goal. And I think you tied the airplane to a crucial landmark within the environment that needed to be shown early. It's all very vague and you're just going to have to wait to see it. But there's a structure that's very important to the story.
Yeah. And as you and I tighten it up, we there's things that you can add in the dialogue to explain the situation. Why are these people up in a plane? Why are they flying over this building? You know, all of those things will play out in the dialogue. And, you know, but I'm in that process now of like, I need this to work without any dialogue, to where you just go from panel to panel and you get the basic story. So, right. You know, that's the difficult thing for me, is I'm still learning all this stuff. Like I have, you know, I haven't hit my 10,000 hours yet. So this is all learning on the fly, for sure. So,
and Dap, as we were going over the story, we wanted to put essentially a comic within a comic.
Okay.
And have events in the, quote, real world kind of conceptually blend with stuff going on in the comic book world. And I don't know how much of that is in it, but again, the enthusiasm that was generated just between us, like, bouncing ideas off each other, we're like, yeah, and I'm like, I guarantee you that we bit off way more than Matt could chew.
Yeah, the editor, and I'm sorry for anybody listening if this is too inside baseball, but the editor even said, you know, when I submitted the final outline, they were like, I'm very interested in seeing how this all comes together, because you got a lot of ideas in there. So I knew right off the bat, like, man, I better, you know, really think about what are the essentials for this story and how can we work that stuff in, but simplify it and make it so that the reader's not confused. And you know, and then I'm also working on another story for them now that somebody else is going to illustrate. And I really pared down my outline for that with just the basics. And then the opposite happened. We're like, why is this happening? Why is this person, you know, doing this? And I'm still trying to find that balance of, you know, when you are dealing with an editor and you're not just doing everything yourself, like, you know, people want information. They want to know exactly what you're turning in. So,
right. I think if we had 22 pages, we would have been able to pull that off, but 9, that's what it is. 9, right?
It is 9. Yeah. I think I got it figured out. I, you know, the comic book stuff, it got jettisoned for about half a day, because I said, like, oh, this kid's going to be reading like a pulp magazine where he's just reading a story with a single illustration. But then I remember, this is going to be translated into French. So if I have a whole bunch of text there, that may not translate as well as just simple lines of dialogue. So I went back to it being a comic book and tried to just tell the story as visually as possible.
Neat. Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Cool. Sounds yeah, good. I think, so it'll be issue 12, believe end of summer. I got to turn the pages in on the 15th, I think, and then there's like a 3 or 4 month gap before it's printed in on shelves.
Nice. I didn't even ask
the publisher.
It's Humanoids, okay. but they don't technically have U.S. distribution. You tell me. I don't know if you've ever seen these in like a Diamonds preview.
No,
not
never.
In a good long okay. while. When they tried to reprint it as like a trade, I think a couple of issues they were trying to do, but they I don't think they ever materialized.
Okay, yeah, they like I said, they keep telling me that this stuff will eventually be released in English, so we'll see.
And I don't. Is it in? Are you coloring it as well?
Yeah, I'm gonna go real minimal with the colors on this, partly because of the time frame, but and I'm using a lot of blacks. This is all taking place at night, so I'm thinking doing more flat colors than I'm used to, but then having certain sections that are maybe a little more embellished.
That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited.
This is like a bucket list. I have something. Even minimal involvement in something in heavy in metal hurlant, so like I could die, I could just die. There you go.
Right on. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Dap. What's floating your boat?
You mean in general?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, considering where these tonight's conversations went. Last time Matthew was here, there was something that popped into my mind. It doesn't have to be deep. What is one piece of... Not even one piece of work. What... They always say you can't take it with you. I am absolutely going to be cremated with at least one prized possession that I own. What is it that you would be buried or cremated with?
Wow. Just one. We can't cheat?
No, you can cheat. I'll let you cheat.
Does it have to be, I'm assuming, comic book related, right?
It could, I mean, it could be, but if okay. I mean, if it could be music related as well at this point, it's whatever, however, something you feel so strongly about that you want to take it with you.
Hmm. Well, I'd throw a Blu-ray. Well, I wouldn't because I would be dead. But I would I would.
You don't know. You don't know how things are going
to
work.
I would instruct the survivors to make sure that there is a copy of, preferably Blu-ray, of Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things.
Yeah, I knew it.
Honestly, I'm not kidding. It is the
why
one-
Blu-ray though? I mean, wouldn't that be too clean or polished?
No, even the Blue Age, the most recent rescan, even that transfer isn't all that great. I mean, it's a shit. It's degraded over time, but it's so strange. I don't know why that thing speaks so loudly to me, but it is probably my favorite thing. Like of all media, it is my favorite thing that's ever been produced by anybody.
It, at this point, for anybody who's been listening to you for as long as they have, it's kind of synonymous with your name.
Yeah. Yeah, and I told Alan Ormsby that, and he couldn't when I was on Facebook, he has a Facebook account, and I just messaged him out of the blue because we were friends. I don't know why, and I told him that. He's like, "You're insane, right?" And I was like, "No." It's the best thing ever. It is. And I'm not ashamed of telling people that. They say, hey, what's your favorite movie? I'm just loud and proud. Shouldn't Play with Dead Things. I love it. And I'm not saying I love chocolate ice cream. I love this movie.
Right.
Yeah.
That was one of those movies, you know, growing up, my parents went to the drive-in so much prior to me being born. You know, so they were just constantly regaling me with all these, you know, stories about these different movies. So they're telling me about She-Devils on Wheels and stuff like that. But they would talk about Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things all the time. And, you know, so it wasn't until the VCR era that I finally found a video store that had it. And it completely lived up to everything they told me about it.
Yeah.
You know, they did not lie to me when it came to that movie. And it's not good. By most people's standards. But that is not the point. Like, the point is, does it take you, are you on that island with those people?
Yeah.
Are you in that room with those people? Are you experiencing this? And I was at the right age to where, because I was probably 13 when I finally saw it, maybe younger, maybe like 10. Which is at the same time that I was seeing like Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first time and Eraserhead for the first time. So these things just burned into my skull. Yep. And the opening sequence of Children Shouldn't Play with Dead Things, when they're digging up that body and or they're going through the cemetery and that guy turns to the camera and then the title yep. flashes onto the screen. It's just
it's crazy.
Such an impact. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, you're right. Is the movie perfect? No, but it's a little slow in spots. I think there's way too much dialogue, but I wouldn't change any of it. I think the zombie rising sequence is the best zombie emerging sequence that's ever been filmed. And I'll add one more: Ring Zombie, the one where Roy goes into the casket and says, "Oh, he forgot his right guard." That is the best zombie ever committed to celluloid.
Yeah.
I'm laying it on thick. It's my favorite movie. And Alan did all those designs and makeup himself. Like, that is insane to me. He starred in the movie. He co-directed it. He did all of the makeup, all of the designs. It's just bizarre how great that movie is. Yeah. But anyway, you mean like comic books? Yeah.
Well, it doesn't have to be. I mean, you just
yeah. I would. See, I'm torn. What do I? I don't have enough room for the complete run of Eerie. Right? There's not enough room in the casket for that.
So you're getting buried?
No, I'm getting cremated.
Oh,
I'm
matter.
Just pretending. Okay. Well, yeah, I wouldn't want to burn those. That's not nice.
Okay.
He's going to have a Viking funeral like Odor Sirungus. We're going to put him out on a canoe in the middle of a lake and shoot a flaming arrow at him.
That's probably going to be more like a cruise ship whatever, at this point.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm deciding now, but it's probably not going to stick. I would go with the Terror on the Planet of the Apes, the Mike Ploog story that ran in Planet of the Apes magazine with, I believe, Doug Munch wrote it.
Wow.
That's like one of my favorite things ever.
That's good.
Yeah. I was crazy for Planet of the Apes back in the day. As are many people my age. Like Planet of the Apes.
Still have never seen a single one of the original Planet of the Apes.
What's happening?
I don't. Yeah, you're the guy who doesn't like John Carpenter's The Thing. So.
Oh, I know. Yeah, that's true. But you know what? On the down low, it's not as bad as I pretend it is. You got to play the role, Matthew.
What would you take with you, Matthew?
Well, in terms of comic books, and this is just, you could take the interior out. The cover to Dark Knight Returns number 2 is the thing that just like, there's certain things in the pinball machine of your life that just sink you into a certain area that you just never recover from. And seeing that cover just put me on this path. Like that was the moment where I was like, this is exactly what I want to do. I want to make something like that. I don't necessarily need to do a Batman comic. I don't need to do something for DC, but it was seeing a person not understanding it this way at the time. Now I look at it, I've analyzed that cover so many times and looked at the artist edition, at the original scan of his pencils and his inks. And I'm just like, this is a person fully expressing themselves. Yes, it's with this iconic character that everybody knows, but it is a symbol of freedom to me as an artist to just be able to like, fuck it. It's such a weird cover that like, in Europe, when the second issue came out, they didn't use that image. Cause I'm sure people were like, we can't, I think it was Europe, maybe South America. There's a version of Dark Knight Returns where it's the same covers for each one, but 2 is different. And I still contend. I believe that he used the Mego pocket, hero's figure for that. And I can just imagine him, like, I'm going to say this, and apologies to anybody that offends, but I could see him coked out of his mind, like, fuck, I got to get a cover done. And he grabbed that little figure, and he just blasted it out in a couple hours. But it is, like, one of the greatest comic book images of all time.
I got to agree with that. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Dap, can I guess?
Sure.
It's either Born Again, or I don't even know what it's called. Like the Hunter Rose.
Devil Deep?
Yeah. Yeah.
That is a good one. You could have also said the Judas Contract, but it is the artist edition of Born Again.
Nice.
Yeah.
Don't get much better.
I have a Matt Wagner story that I wanted to tell. When I was at OAX, the original art convention.
The one in Florida. Back in
January. Yeah. So we got there late. Aaron Conley and his wife drove us there. And go up to my room. We get checked in. I go up to my room and my key won't work. So I'm like, oh shit. So I knew the elevators were running slow at this place. It's super packed because it's right next to all the amusement parks. So it's not just the convention. It's like everybody going to Disney and going to Universal and all those places. So I see that there's a sign saying that there's a freight elevator if the main elevator's not working. So I go around the corner and go in the freight elevator. And I take it down to the bottom floor, and I am in like a Freddy Krueger boiler room when I get off that elevator. And I'm looking around, I'm like, this can't be right. Like, and I can hear people on the other side of this door, but the door is locked. And I start going down this little hallway, and it doesn't really go anywhere. It's just like super creepy. And I'm like, well, I guess I'll go back up the elevator. And I press the button, and the door's open, and there's Matt Wagner standing there. I was like, I don't know where I'm supposed to be. And he's like, follow me. And he takes me around the corner and we go through this door. I didn't introduce myself to him or anything like that, but it was, you know, he saved me from certain death down in that creepy basement. So, yeah, it was very kind of him.
That's great.
Well, he is a hero.
He is.
Yes.
Jason and our North Carolina boys are talking about hitting that convention up next year.
Yeah, you definitely, they, of course, I mean, Jason, yeah. My God, the stuff, I didn't even really get a chance to look around. So I'm standing there at the end of the weekend, and there's this small group of people hovering around this guy who's got this framed picture, and I look, and it's John Romita's original Wolverine drawing, like the preliminary, you know, sketches that we've all seen, you know, and reproduced a million times, but he's got the original thing. And there was just stuff like that that would pass by me all weekend. Like, it's crazy that people just bring this stuff to conventions just to show off. Like, mm-hmm. You brought that on a plane? Insane to me. So, but yeah, I saw Corbin art. I saw Brian Boland 2000 AD art there. It was wild. It was very cool.
Danny Boland Camelot 3000 art. So the when the topic came up, I mean, I haven't been to a theme park in decades, but Jason was concerned about what exactly Vince and I would be doing while they're all looking at original art, because everybody knows when we go to cons and Jason goes and on his heart hustle, Vince and I hit the back issues, and I don't believe there are any back issues to be found.
And, no.
I don't know.
Just art.
Yeah.
Interesting.
We'll see. We'll have to mull it over.
I'm sure we'll have a good time, but
you know, for sure. Look at it this way. It's like going to a museum. You know, you don't have to buy any of it.
That's true.
You just spend the entire weekend looking through all this stuff. I mean, one guy had folder after folder of Kirby pages and Ditko pages. And so, like, yeah, I would like to go back, not even table, just be able to go and look at all everything that was there.
We'll make sure to enter the room with 32-ounce drinks without caps on them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Can you imagine everybody having a stroke? Like, get away.
And uncapped Sharpies.
Yeah.
It's so weird how blasé these guys are about this stuff.
Really?
They just are like so, it doesn't mean anything to them. I mean, they've got millions of dollars worth of stuff that they're just hauling around in vans, you know?
Wow. That's a life. Yeah. All right, everybody. Hey, thank you for being here with us one more time around. We hope you come back next time. Please solicit our sponsor, cheapgraphicnovels.com, if you want to save. If you don't want to save, then go somewhere else. Cheapgraphicnovels.com and the Patreon page, patreon.com/11oclockcomics. There's a mess of stuff. It would take another 10 minutes to tell you all of the things that we offer our patrons. Not the least of which is the bonus episode per month. You get a book of the month episode, 2 hours plus, that nobody else gets to hear. And should you decide to join the Slack tier, wow, the world opens up. Discussions about everything with like-minded individuals. We have downloads of vintage fanzines, original pages, covers, spotlights, just a whole mess of fun that I just thank my lucky stars that the damn thing exists. And you'll never guess whose idea it was.
Whose?
It was yours.
Oh, shit.
you knew that. You knew it.
And where else do you get to see Simon Kudransky artwork?
Now, see, that's my In Your Travels.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
it is. Take it away. That was my segue.
It is. In Your Travels. I would like to warn you.
Oof.
I don't usually squander my In Your Travels warning you to stay away from things. But yesterday saw the release of another book in McFarlane's extended Spawn universe. And now, one thing that on which you know a fan could always depend was that, for the most part, if they didn't read well, McFarlane books always looked decent to extraordinary. It's a pretty big window, but for the most part, they always looked at least good. Well, the streak is broken because Sam and Twitch, number one, came out Wednesday, and it pretty much is an abomination. I didn't expect much going in because the artist is Simon Kudransky, and I know I shit on this guy a lot, but Todd, if you're listening, why are you wasting your money? There are plenty of far more talented artists out there that are looking for work. So please, I mean, the book is just... Matt, there's one page where there's three panels duplicated.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and the anatomy's wrong. The rendering is weird. It's a strange looking book. And I don't want to be that guy that comes, you know, bringing the badness, because that's not me. But it breaks my heart to see good paper wasted on this stuff. So, yeah, just stay away from Sam and Twitch, number one. I pre-ordered 1 and 2. I will not make that mistake again. Moving forward.
Hmm.
Yeah. Bring us up, somebody.
This is a little bittersweet because it's the end of book one, the end of the first volume. It's still a gorgeous first volume. But the fifth issue of Petrolhead wraps up this first arc. Of course, as we've talked about the previous four issues, written by Rob Williams, art by Pi Parr. It's the end of the fourth issue and parts of the fifth issue. Hurt my heart a little bit because of a particular character, but I am really excited for what the future holds going forward with this series. But yeah, the collection, or book one rather, I think is, okay, volume one, June. So, be on the lookout for that if it wasn't in the recent, Image solicits. It will be soon. So if you weren't on board from the beginning, shame on you, but you'll be able to catch up soon enough. So yeah, in your travels, catch up or check out Petrolhead.
Yeah, Pipar is ridiculous.
It really is.
Absolutely just jaw-droppingly just intricate, gorgeous, amazing art.
And it's one book where I know we've said this about so many other artists, and just, you know, if you just want to look at the line work, or the work will still look stellar in black and white. The coloring that Pipar puts on these pages is just, it just pops, man. It's so gorgeous.
And he's a graphic designer that can illustrate really well. I mean, you could tell when guys are just going in and they're just... Guys and gals, they're just throwing down. The composition is fine, but it's not as comprehensive as someone who thinks about fonts and balloon placement and text scrawls. And it's just amazing. It was a surprise when that book came out, because it's unlike anything that's out there right now. Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Human characters, tech, it doesn't matter. My man can do it all.
Good pick.
Thank you. What you got, Mandy?
I have a movie, but it is comic book related. It's on Tubi and Amazon Prime, and it's the Dave Stevens documentary, Drawn to Perfection. It came out in 2022. There's so many documentaries out, and they're all kind of the same thing. You just get a bunch of people who knew the subject and, you know, do some interviews and show some archival footage. But this one was really, really captivating. And I didn't know a lot about Dave Stevens going into it, his personal life. But it was fascinating. And he said some things in this. There were some quotes from him that really, really surprised me in terms of his view of his own art. The process of making art. So not just if you're a fan of Dave Stevens, but just want to get inside the head of an artist. It's really, really well done. Lots of great information, lots of great imagery, of course. You know, you get to see some old footage of Brink Stevens. So that's always a plus. But Dave Stevens, Drawn to Perfection.
The Tubi, so I'm going to have to check that out.
Yeah.
Nice.
There's a Spain Rodriguez documentary on there too that's really good.
You know, I never, like, I don't think I utilize all of the nooks and crannies of Tubi. Like, I'll go there for, you know, certain things, and then okay, I'll move on to something else. But yeah, Matt, do you subscribe to Night Flight?
No, I have a good friend who's constantly, you know, getting on me about subscribing to that, and I don't, you know.
It's great with reservations.
Okay.
For whatever reason, certain channels crap out. Like, they have a vinegar syndrome channel.
Okay.
And whenever I click on a movie, it'll begin to play and then it resets my Roku. And it's only on the vinegar syndrome channel.
That's weird.
Or I'm sorry, Severin. And it's like what? Vinegar Syndrome's on there too, and they have like a shit ton of Something Weird. Of course, all of the Night Flight, a lot of the Night Flight episodes. It's really good, but the interface is clunky as hell.
Yeah, that's too bad. I used to have a subscription to. Sorry, the CBD's really kicking in, so I'm awesome. A little mush mouthed.
That's good.
There was exploitation.tv, which was the Vinegar Syndrome channel. And that went away. So I was looking for an alternative to that. And I didn't realize, I thought Night Flight was just re-airings of the old episodes. I had no idea they had all these sub-channels to it. So I'll definitely check on that.
And they're not afraid to show something with explicit sex.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really cool. But, nice. So there you go. All right, everybody. Hey, do yourself a favor. Get yourselves out there, buy some comics, talk about them, read them, come back here, and we'll probably be talking about them too. So, you know the drill. Say goodnight. David.
And I...
People, I gotta tell you, I hear there's a lot of you out there that like to drink vodka and orange juice.
Oh my goodness.
David.
Nice, nice. All right, we're out of here. Tell them you love them so much.
So much. So much more than life.
Love you.
Wow.
That's it for that one.